Welcome to the Your Gateway to Wealth and Fulfillment podcast. I'm Andrew Kittleson, joined by my team member Candace Klein. We are financial advisors with Gateway Wealth Management at UBS. We're located in Charlotte, North Carolina, and can be reached at 704-362-8260. Our guest today is Keith Ludeman, entrepreneur, mentor, and speaker. He is not affiliated with UBS, and his views are his own. Keith, we're very excited to have you today. Talk about your journey as an entrepreneur and how you're helping the Charlotte community. So I think it'd be appropriate to start with, how did you get started? Yeah, I know you started in the Army. Talk to us a little bit about your early career.
Oh, that's a lot of fun. Yeah, I was in the Army National Guard. And, you know, you look at kids these days, and I think it was back in 82 when Reagan was elected president. I was convinced we were going to war. So I wanted to fight with people I knew. So I made the very intelligent decision at 18, you know, how smart 18-year-olds are, to join the National Guard. Turned out to be a great thing. You know, I get a discount at Lowe's when I go into shop now. So it's fantastic. Went to Clemson. I had two sets of friends. I had my athlete friends and I had my math honor society friends. So I learned very early on how to get two people to communicate when they have very little in common. Somehow I was in the middle of that and went to work for IBM. After college, with the simple decision of they paid you the same whether you lived in Greenville, South Carolina, Miami, or New York. And I picked Greenville, South Carolina, so I could go back for football games and see college friends. And started my entrepreneurial journey because IBM at that point was really starting to change rapidly from a hardware company to a software services systems integrations company. And in the state of South Carolina, they were looking for two people to start up the services and consulting business. And I'm convinced that they went through the roster of people in the office and they picked the two youngest guys because everybody else said, no, I'm happy making $100,000 selling mainframes. But I was honored at that time and we went out and did some really interesting things and didn't get fired along the way. Like we did a project where we put mobile data terminals in the highway patrol cars in the state of South Carolina, which is basically a laptop. And yeah, again, being an idiot 25-year-old, we would start the demo by dumping a cup of water on it and hit it with a baseball bat and then going into the demo. Because their number one objection was, the cops are going to break them. So we just took that right off the table. And you should have seen the look on my manager's office when the face when he heard that we were doing that. But we got over it. We won the contract. We won the deal. And with that, I got promoted to Charlotte, North Carolina, and turned around the services business here. And at that point, got tired of people raining down from headquarters that were going to keep my career from advancing. So naively went out and joined another startup of former IBMers and embraced the Microsoft way. And it was Sykes Enterprises and ended up growing that and selling that. I had a very small ownership piece and did that a couple times and said, it's time to do it for myself. And that's when I started GoodMortgage.com in 1999. So that's the Cliff Note version.
So what did your life look like when you opened the doors? Like, how were you feeling? Were you scared, confident, the above?
Well, all the above, because my previous role, I was doing the integration of JBA software with Avnet, which is a Fortune 100 company out of Scottsdale. And my life before that was waking up and going, I'm cold, I must be in Philly. Or I don't feel right, I must be jet lagged, I must be in Scottsdale, or I'm home, right? So I said, it can't be more work than that if I'm going to start my own company. And if you think about 1999, internet stocks were doing fantastic and I was heavily invested. That changed about a year later and I'm like, holy crap, this really has to work. But I was excited. It's an interesting feeling that when you realize your paycheck comes from the business that you produce, you know, you're eating what you kill and nobody's there to save you if you don't. And I enjoyed that. And it really energized me every day to go in, you know, work as hard as I could, try to make the best decisions and continue to grow the company. And, you know, 16 years later, I was at an overnight success. Only took 16 years, right?
Now, were you confident all the way, kind of along the way, or were there ever any moments of doubt like a lot of entrepreneurs might have? Or did you know, hey, I'm gonna make this happen, no doubt.
You know, that's a really good question because I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs about that. And I think the right formula is to be confident 95% of the time and 5% extreme paranoia about what could happen to you. And in those moments, write down, okay, if this happens, this is what we do. So you have at least a game plan. And we didn't count on the financial crisis in 2008. But if we knew the flow of mortgage mortgages and mortgage-backed securities through the big banks would fail. We were hoping that Fannie Mae stepped in. Turned out they did. If subprime mortgages went away, we would move to FHA loans, which we did. So spending that time of being a little worried, paranoid, is healthy. But when you're out working with the employees, I mean, you're the leader. They're looking at you and how you react. So it's not fake it until you make it. You really do feel that confident. Looking back on it, like, how the heck did I feel that way the whole time? You know, I should have been more scared because we made it through the dot-com crash. Thankfully, we had not raised any funds, so we didn't have to worry about outside investors. You know, we made it through the financial crisis of 2008, right when we had bought a 44,000 square foot call center, personally guaranteed. I'm like, holy crap, I've worked for 10 years and now we're going to lose it all if this doesn't turn around. The good news is it did turn around. So I think it's a good dichotomy of being extremely confident with a little bit of being extremely paranoid about what could happen. I think that's the right mix. That's why you got to be crazy to be an entrepreneur, right?
Right. So you almost, you know, going into it, you're going to have to pivot.
Yes.
A bit at some point.
Challenges are going to happen whether you want them or not.
Yeah. Well, what were some of the biggest challenges early on and you went through the growth of your company?
Well, I mean, one, of course, in 2008 was the entire collapse of the housing industry. And, you know, we looked at some numbers and said, all right, if we continue at this pace, you know, we've got about a year and a half of cash. So we're hoping that, you know, the market's going to change. And thankfully, it did change about 2 days before Thanksgiving when the Fed came in and did a major drop. And, you know, then it was off to the races. That holiday season was really interesting because everybody wanted to talk about mortgages. No one wanted to buy or sell a house, but they all wanted to refi. So it was a lot of fun. That challenge, you know, being an entrepreneur in Charlotte, and again, this is 25 years ago. I mean, Charlotte is such a great place to be an entrepreneur now. You meet somebody and say, I'm an entrepreneur, and they pull you aside later on at the party and say, send me a resume, I'll get you a job at the bank. They thought entrepreneur was code word for unemployed consultant, which it, you know, wasn't. I mean, it's a growing, thriving industry. It used to be maybe once a month there was something to do with an entrepreneur or startup meetup. And now there's one a day, sometimes three a day, where you can find people that are thinking like you, you know, taking the risk, having the entrepreneurial mindset. And that's so refreshing to be able to talk to other people that are doing the same thing. Gives you confidence in what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, you really were ahead of the curve in the fintech startups in Charlotte.
Yeah, I guess I look back and go, how did that happen? Because I didn't think I was going to grow up to be an entrepreneur. I think that little taste of victory when I was 25 at IBM really gave me the confidence to take steps going forward. You know, one interesting side effect is when I went to work for Sykes, I found it harder to get appointments. Then it occurred to me that it's a lot easier to get appointments if you have IBM on your business card as opposed to a name that nobody knows. And I remember after two or three days, I went to HR and said, hey, I think I got a problem. No one's emptying my trash can. And they're like, that's because you're supposed to empty it every day. Oh. So that was a little bit of a wake-up call. So I guess I kind of eased in to being an entrepreneur and really embraced it bit by bit as I went from, you know, a super big company to a smaller company to, hey, it's me that's got to pay the bills and make it work at the end of the day.
How did that impact your family life?
You know, I had a wife that I started dating a couple of years before I founded goodmortgage.com. And either her confidence or naivety, I'm not sure which one, she's like, you'll figure it out. You'll make it work. And I'm like, okay. I also learned pretty early on that you don't come home and talk about what's going on in your business because it's always chaos. I found if you ever talk to an entrepreneur, hey, how are things are going? The answer you're going to get is things are going okay. When in reality, you're going to have customer problems, technology problems, funding problems. Something is going to go on that is chaos that only another entrepreneur will understand that it'll work out. It'll be okay. Give it 3 days and something will change. Where your friend group or your spouse or your family isn't necessarily going to appreciate that and give you the support that you need. So that's why mentoring, working with other entrepreneurs, having people that can relate to what you're going through is so important. Whether it's an organization like YEO or Entrepreneurs Organization, where you're talking to other CEOs. And that's why Charlotte is doing so well as an entrepreneurial hub, because there's more people that are entrepreneurs and they support each other and they, you know, build confidence. Interesting side story. I sat down with five or so friends one night and fed them a bunch of wine and said, you know, you ask me how I'm doing and you always hear, okay. You know, what have I told you things weren't okay? And I think they were just, you know, and had vibed just enough to tell me that if you tell me things aren't okay, I'm going to go, nobody wants to be around a failure. Or if I tell you things are going great, they're going to go, well, you're an entrepreneur, so you're rich anyway, which is a big fallacy. You're normally not rich. You're the opposite of rich when you start your company. So that taught me a lesson of find people you trust that you can share your journey with. They're going to give you good advice, and maybe you can share with them on the other side too.
Yeah. There really are so many different great peer groups for entrepreneurs across the globe in this city. So you can find the resources you need if you're getting started.
Yeah. I got to give a shout out to Terry Cox, who's now at TechWorks Gaston, that she put together a group. I think it was in 2002 that had people like David Jones with Peak 10. And I get to give him now a $1 trillion company, or it's going to be a billion, multi-billion dollar company now, but invented cloud computing, so to speak. He got 10 or so of us together and said, hey, we all know of each other. We don't really know each other, but we get a treat list like Vegas. What we talk about in this room stays in this room. And that's one of the areas that I learned that everybody is going through the same problems, and having somebody else that could, you know, say when somebody brings up a problem, two people will go, hey, I've had that problem. Here's how you fix it. Somebody else in the room is having the same problem. And two people are going, hey, I think that we're going to have that problem sometime soon. And what's interesting is out of the core eight, because we had two drop out, six of the eight went through exits. And I think that's got to be because of the peer support that we got from each other.
How do young entrepreneurs, or not even young, any entrepreneur, how do they find a group like that?
There are so many. I mean, with the meetups around town, you could form that organically by finding people that maybe you're competitive, maybe you're not, maybe somebody who's open is going to support you in the way that you want to. EO is a fantastic organization, and there are dozens of them that you can go and join, and they will curate the group that makes the most sense for you. I was cheap and I found a free one, so I stayed with that one.
And you said that was a meetup? Is that what it was? Or
yeah, we met once a month. Yeah. We'd meet for breakfast. And God, it's been 25 years. We're actually having a reunion. People are flying in from all over the country, February 11th, that we're all going to get together and see each other. It's been a while since I've talked to any of them other than David Jones and Thad Thrumberg.
That's great. I mean, so many of our business owner clients are part of EO, Vistage, and those type of organizations, and talk about how it's incredibly valuable. It's one of the reasons why we do our business owner dinners, to get like-minded business owners together, just to peer share and foster relationships that can help grow businesses. Going back kind of early on, I feel like one of the knocks on Charlotte was we didn't have the capital or the funding here locally that other cities around the country may have. That's evolved a bit. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of what you've seen through your kind of perspective?
That is. And, I heard that all along. And we had some later stage companies for growth, like Frontier Capital has been around for a long time. And, they're later stage. I think the biggest gap was probably, early on and the kind of in-between stage. And things have changed dramatically. Greg Brown, what he's done with the Charlotte Angel Fund has been fantastic, where you want to learn about angel investing. It's $25,000 or $30,000 to join the fund, depending on where they are in their life cycle. Oddly enough, it's been the most successful fund I'm part of. They've already returned all the capital, and now we're in profit land. But it got people used to investing, because the knock I heard 20 years ago, a lot of people make money in real estate in Charlotte as fast as it's growing. It's it's a very safe and fun way to do that. But you ought to have 5 to 10% of your assets in risk capital. And investing in startups is a great way to make money slowly over time, but you can make a lot of money and you invest in the right company. A story a lot of people have forgotten, it was so long ago, in 1999, there were 20 people to get together and formed something called the Charlotte Angel Partner. They all put in 100 grand and they invested 100,000 in 20 internet startups. GoodMortgage.com was not one of them. 19 of them were out of business within a year, and the 20th was AvidXchange, which I think paid out 70-1, but it only took 20 years. But it gave angel investing a bad name at that point in time. But so after I sold my company, wife said, take 6 months off. And I'm like, all right, take 6 months off, go out and see what's going on in the ecosystem. And I heard that from day one, and this is 2016, startups going, there aren't enough people investing locally in Charlotte. And I'm on the LP side, I'm in a bunch of funds, and they're going, we can't find enough good companies locally here in Charlotte that are ready for investment. And there were some things that we got to do some education, because we had people that would meet with their venture fund and go, they really like me. They like my idea. They think I'm going to be a success, but they said they can't invest in me. And I thought that was a cheap way out. I'm like, no, if they're investing in fintech B2C companies, they made that promise to their LP. They can't invest in you no matter how much they like you. So let's get you investor ready. Let's get you in front of the right funds at the right time. Because a seed stage company is not going to invest in you if you're almost ready for your Series A, or vice versa. But now if you look at the landscape in Charlotte, we've got the Charlotte Angel Fund for startups. The Charlotte Fund is a fantastic story. And what Mark McDowell and his team have done is great, because 60% of the funds in the fund, the LPs, are former entrepreneurs. And they invest in companies local in Charlotte, whether they're seed stage or whether they're just about to go public and have an exit. So the returns are really good and really healthy, and it's supporting the Charlotte ecosystem. But there are so many funds, and money is so available these days. Right now, the lockup is because a lot of companies aren't going public. You know, the LPs are jammed up, so they're not getting the returns from the fund, even though the value is there. So we're hoping in the next year, more of those funds will have exits. We'll be able to invest in the next generation of funds as they come forward. But the funding landscape in Charlotte and across North Carolina is good if you're prepared and you're talking to the right people.
You mentioned when you exited your business, you took 6 months off. Mm-hmm. Like, when did exiting your business first cross your mind?
In about 2004, oddly enough, and it didn't happen in 2016. So in 2004, about 5 years in, which is fairly typical, we were starting to get some pretty decent offers for the company and said, all right, I think it's time. And as we were going down the path with some of those companies, they said, oh, but we're going to have you convert to being a subprime company because the margins are so much better and your reach attracting customers over the internet that we could easily be nationwide in no time at all. Well, in 2000 and 2001, there was a little thing called the Russian currency crisis that we were exposed to. We had a little bit of subprime lending. At that time, I think 45% of the housing in North Carolina was manufactured homes, which are very well built homes, by the way. And those were subprime loans, mostly, instead of conforming. And we saw how that market locked up and companies went out of business. So we've got in the back of our head, hey, subprime is probably not where to go. So we decided not to pursue those avenues, thinking, you know, subprime, the extreme subprime that was happening, you know, 100% financing on investment homes with a 600 credit score just makes no sense in hindsight. So we stayed away from it. And the competitors I know that did embrace that with an earnout were out of business a year later, and it missed the whole thing. But we were very consciously looking at that early on, because that's my experience. Go with a startup, work 5 to 7 years, and then you sell it. And at that point, we're like, I think we'll be doing this for a while, because nobody wanted to talk about buying a mortgage company between 2008 and 2012. We had the benefit of reinvesting in the company. So we won the Online Lender of the Year in 2011, which was a great honor. And they looked at everything in our company. And at that point, people started looking at us with some big names. And it ended up in 2016 with an exit to PIMCO. So it worked out. 16 years later.
What was that process like? Were you approached by PIMCO? Did you hire a banker to run a process for you? And kind of what did you learn through that process that you pass on to other entrepreneurs?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'd been through the process before with other companies that we'd sold. In this case, we weren't actively seeking the exit, but we had so much press from the Online Lender of the Year that we had Apollo out of New York and PIMCO both coming after us at the same time. And I said, why am I going to hire an investment banker? I've got two of the top five biggest talking to us, and their numbers are fairly similar. Which one is going to be the right fit for us down the road? So I can't advise that that's the way that everybody ought to do it. But I could tell you, I took a lot of that money and hired a really good attorney from King & Spalding. Yeah. And looking back on that, that was probably a great decision because they were able to walk me through a lot of the T's and C's that could bite us. And I'm finding that, you know, there's pretty common things. There's also deal exhaustion. When you're very close to close, they want to drop the number a little bit. And you're like, oh, I just want to get this over the finish line. Yeah. Well, you learn not to play that game, that it's a little bit of a bluff. And that's one of the biggest things that I had a dozen people tell me that that's going to happen. And it happened. Did. Yeah. It happened. And I'm like, no, that's not going to happen.
Especially from the really big guys, right? Yeah. The bigger they are, maybe the more pressure you're going to get towards the end, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
the day after the deal closed, how did you feel? What were you thinking? Did you have a plan of what you were going to do next?
You know, that's the other thing I tell founders as you go through that, and I find out the answer is always the same. I'm like, it's so anticlimactic. You know, you're looking, you're refreshing, and all of a sudden the money hits your bank account. And I'm like, where's the party? Where are the balloons? No one's going to get them for you. So I sent my admin out to get a bunch of Dom Perignon and some balloons and had a little celebration with my management team. But it's so anticlimactic because the year leading up to that, you're running your company and you're involved in this life-changing event to sell the company. And you've got to take care of the employees and you've got to get your management team involved. So it's so much work leading up to that little ding. Here it is. The money's in your account. It's all over. And you don't even have a signing party. You sign all the documents and fax them in and the attorney puts them all together and sends them out. You know, it should be more fun.
So in our experience in working with business owners, a lot of times there's regret and you know, emotional. It's like you're giving away your baby. So right. It sounds like I'm sure you've seen that before.
100 times. Yeah. And I was telling you, I was supposed to stay on for 3 years afterwards. I barely made it 2. And that's a very common story of life-changing things that happen along those lines. And what's interesting is after that happened, my wife had 6 months off, she had a reoccurrence of breast cancer and passed away. So it was beautiful that I wasn't still working because now I can take care of my daughter and, you know, spend the time with that. But it's amazing how all things come together, if you believe, right?
Absolutely. How did you, obviously you wanted to give back after that 6 months was up and you're taking care of your daughter. When did you get back into, or not back into, but when did you start giving back, becoming a mentor within the Charlotte community?
Yeah, that was right around 2016. While I was still working, I got a little involved. And when I had 6 months to do whatever I wanted to, other than start a startup, I was on the board of the previous organization that became Innovate Charlotte. And my first board meeting back, the executive director said, we got about 100 grand left in the bank. You know, you got to pay me. I'm going to peace out. And everybody's looking around like, what are we going to do? And I'm like, well, I don't need a paycheck. And this sounds fun. And now I'm working on problems that are very long clock that, you know, how do you make Charlotte a better entrepreneurial city? Can't be solved in our lifetime. It's like a constant gradient. There's no finish line. And we were able to raise some funds. And now we have an excellent executive director who is paid, Juan Garzon, who's doing fantastic things with Pitch Breakfast, with Introduction to the Charlotte Ecosystem. And that and so many other organizations have sprung up to help that. So now I'm back on the board chair, probably going to roll off within the next year or two. So that organization is off and launched and doing fantastic things. And then COVID hit. So we're all in the home. And then my wife passed away about a year or two later. After 6 months, she's like, go start a company, get out of the house, which I found, you know, is very common. You know, your lifestyle has changed. And I said, no, I think I'm having fun. Just, you know, not having a bunch of employees, which I love and were stressful at the same time. But, you know, when you're running a business, you know, you've got your own things to deal with. You could have just had a great conversation with a customer or an employee, or you could have had a terrible conversation with a customer or an employee. But the next person that walks in your door, you've got to be there for them. And that emotional muscle is very good once it gets trained. But once I stopped using it, I'm like, I'm glad I don't have to go through that every day. I can feel my own emotions as opposed to giving my employees what they need. So it was fun. It was easy to not to go start anything.
What is the next step for Keith? What are you working on or thinking about as you roll off the board and are looking at other opportunities?
Yeah, a really good question. One, I still have quite a bit of real estate, including the business, the building that we put our company into, and it's going to be a great carbon performance gym is going to be here. It's going to be like Equinox with hot cold plunges and everything else. They're moving to town and they're going to open up in July. So being the landlord, I've got a lot of work I need to do along the way. I'm on the board of, you know, a ton of organizations, the Queen's University Entrepreneur Leadership Circle that is connecting Queens and now Elon to the local startup community has been fantastic. So we've got a pitch competition that happens every year and creating those mentor relationships has been a whole lot of fun. There's actually a statewide board, the NC Idea Foundation, which we've got some 50, 60 million that we give away 5 million or more every year in the form of grants. So if you're interested, you ought to look at the seed grants or micro grants where a company can get you know, tens of thousands of dollars for a startup without diluting any equity. And it's the NC Idea Foundation is there to support, you know, startups all across the state for economic development. And it's a fantastic organization. Other states are very jealous of what we have. We're doing some work now with the folks in York County and Rock Hill. South Carolina has something called the SCRA, which again is a venture fund that invests via grants and then later equity in startups in the state of North Carolina and is doing fantastic. But it's only within the geography of South Carolina. And now Charlotte, some people from Charlotte, it's kind of interesting. If you're in the ecosystem of startups, you know all the good stuff that's going on. If you're outside of it or you're a business owner heads down, you don't know anything about it. You don't think much is going on here. So how do we get more exposure for that? And I can tell you that people in surrounding geographies think we have it figured out here in Charlotte, which is interesting, right? Because we look at RTP and go, there's so much more going on in RTP. I'm spending enough time in RTP. They're looking, what's going on in Charlotte? So it's interesting, and there's no finish line, which is very different from when I was driven by monthly goals, quarterly goals, yearly goals. You know, what's the goal here? It's a long clock problem. And to me, that's fun. I'm doing something new.
Yeah. How do you advise new entrepreneurs in, you know, fundraising and needing help but not giving away too much equity? I mean, how do you strike that balance?
Yeah, it's really good. One. And it, to be fair, when you say advising, I don't get paid. I do it for fun, right? Because it's so easy. I think my value right now is knowing people. So I just know who to introduce other people to, and you know, they do the work. That's such an interesting question, because I tell entrepreneurs, would you rather have 100% of a company you sell for $25 million or 10% of a company you sell for $250 million? You know, one's a whole lot more work, but at the end of the day, you're going to make the same amount of money. And when I talked to younger entrepreneurs, I said, all right, let's say you sell your company for $20 million. After you go buy your nice car and whatever, you've got $10 million in the bank. They're like, that's not enough. And I'm like, well, let's think about that. That's $250,000 a year for the next 40 years with no taxes. And that's assuming zero appreciation. And you're an exited founder, it's so much easier to start your next one. And they're like, holy crap. You know? So it's the numbers don't have to be huge. So if you have somebody else invest in you, you're going to be on the clock. You're going to need an exit in the next 5 to 10 years. You're not as in control of your destiny. That's fine. Some companies are built and they need the money to scale quickly for that exit. Some don't. So the answer is different for everybody along the way.
All right, great. So if an entrepreneur, young entrepreneur is just getting going, where's the kind of one place they should go to rather than you giving us your cell phone number and calling Keith Ludeman? Where does somebody go to if they really want to start educating themselves on the right way to do this?
Really good question. So I think the first thing that a person should do is go to the Innovate Charlotte website and then sign up for the newsletter. You'll start to get emails telling you about the entrepreneurial events that are going on in Charlotte. And by the way, just show up, right? Don't be intimidated. You know, everybody's there looking for advice and they're looking to help, and it's a very welcoming. And then if you look at some of the events that they have, Pitch Breakfast, where it's a breakfast, you show up and you see three companies pitch. But by the way, there's no money being exchanged hands. It's three venture capitalists on the panel that give advice about what they could do different or better to refine the idea. So it's going to help you sharpen your sword. You can go to the Introduction to the Charlotte Ecosystem, which will tell you some of the other resources around town. I think that happens about once a quarter. And just find the events that you want to go and show up. You'll find your crowd. And I can't think of a better way to start.
Fantastic. Well, for a team that works with business owners, we really appreciate the work you do in, you know, educating and growing the startup community here. And really appreciate you taking the time today to share your experience and advice with us. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.